The sixth case, Shue v. Pierce. Ms. Hogan.
Good morning, judges. The singular claim before this court this morning is Mr. Shue's claim that his trial, conviction, and sentence, all of which were overseen by Circuit Court Judge John Morrissey, were tainted improperly in violation of the Due Process Clause by judicial bias. The two issues that this court needs to decide today are as follows. Does the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution guarantee litigants a trial free of even the appearance of bias? And if, as I submit, the answer to that is absolutely yes, has Mr. Shue shown enough to get the relief that he seeks? Let's talk about the first question. There is no right more fundamental than the right to an impartial judge. As this court stated in Bracey, impartiality is the life of justice. All of the rules that we as a collective legal governing body have come up with through our Constitution, through our rules of civil procedure, and through 200 years of case law mean nothing if the partiality of the judge who's overseeing the trial and entrusted with the trial is questioned. And, of course, it goes without saying that judicial bias is a structural error that requires automatic reversal. In other words, it's not subject to the harmless error doctrine. Now, the state claims primarily that Mr. Shue is not entitled to relief because there is no U.S. Supreme Court case that clearly establishes that appearance of bias is equally as offensive to the Due Process Clause as actual bias. Well, I have two things to say to that. One is, I don't believe that that standard or that restriction applies to this court because I don't believe AEDPA restrictions prohibit this court from deciding this case de novo. The lower court did not address this claim, and therefore there's no deference that you need pay to the lower court's decision. But having said that, I believe the state is absolutely wrong when it tells you that there is no federally established law on this point. First of all, we cited a numerous amount of cases, Toomey, Murchison, Aetna, that clearly established that the appearance of bias is equally offensive to the Due Process Clause as actual bias. This court itself...
Was actual bias the issue that was argued in state court as opposed to appearance?
Judge, it was both. First of all, we disagree with the state that you can sort of slice the bologna that thin. I mean, a judicial bias claim, I believe, inherently includes both of those issues. But if you look at the reply brief that was filed in the Illinois Appellate Court, we very clearly raised the very issue that we're talking about today, which is the appearance of bias. So it was raised absolutely in the state court.
Well, the state defends in part on a waiver issue that you didn't raise that.
That's
and
right.
It did seem like the emphasis was on actual bias and the hearings, everything that went on state court was to demonstrate to at least the state court's satisfaction that the judge really didn't know about this. So there was no actual bias issue.
Well, Judge, I think if you look at the state court proceedings sort of devolved into more of a discovery dispute. So we were talking a lot about what the standard was for obtaining discovery. But when you look at the briefs filed in the Illinois Appellate Court, we absolutely raised the very claim that we're arguing this morning. We cited the same cases. We argue that appearance of bias was sufficient under the Due Process Clause to get the relief Mr. Shue seeks. So the state is wrong when they say that we did not raise that in the state court because we did. The state court did not address it in any way, but we absolutely raised that issue in the state court. And as far as procedural default, I believe that the state is barred from raising that, judges, because I think they've absolutely explicitly waived that defense here because they raised it as to one of Mr. Shue's claims, his Fourth Amendment search and seizure claim, but they chose to address this judicial bias claim on its merits. And they had many, many opportunities since we've been up here in the federal district court to argue that we had procedurally defaulted this claim, and they never did. So I believe that they can't argue that before this court now. Okay. So this court, both in Bracey versus Shomig and Franklin, held that appearance of bias is enough to violate the Due Process Clause and that that is well-established federal law. So what is the standard? Well, how do we decide what is appearance of bias? I think the best case to look to for that is the Liljeburg case. Now, the state wants you to say, state is going to say to you, Liljeburg is a 455 case. Don't listen to it. It has nothing to do with due process. But I don't know how they can say that. Liljeburg is the U.S. Supreme Court's case where they tell us what appearance of bias means. Now, why they are definitely defining that under a federal recusal statute, how on earth can the definition of appearance of bias be different for a recusal statute than it can be for due process? And if the state hasn't offered any explanation for how that definition could be different, appearance of bias is appearance of bias. And Liljeburg teaches us that how you determine if there is appearance of bias is you look at the objective evidence and you ask, even in hindsight, even for retroactive recusal of a judge, you ask whether a reasonable person would look at the evidence you've been able to amass and say, I believe the judge may have been not have been impartial in that case. That is the standard that applies. So the question is, has Mr. Sue developed enough evidence to convince you that he meets that standard? And I believe the answer is absolutely yes. Time prohibits me from going into all of the reasons that we've established in our brief, so I'm going to do one. And that is, the one unique part about this case that I've never seen in any other judicial bias case is that this claim came to us. Mr. Sue believed that his appeal rights were over. It was done. And then someone came to us and said, this trial was influenced by the family of the victim, and you should look into that. We did look into it, and lo and behold, we established a 50-year relationship between the victim's family and Judge Johnny Morrissey. Now, the state, it tells you that Patrick Lavery, this part-time playwright, with no reason, education, specific education, or means to discover this sort of convoluted relationship, made this whole thing up. They want you to believe that he made this whole thing up, rather than believing that Sister McCary, who was intimately involved with the family of the victim and Mr. Sue's family, came to us and said, something's wrong, someone should look into it. And there's subsequent corroborating evidence of that. There's the meeting between Judge John Devane and Sister McCary. Very strange to us that they would get together and talk about this if there was nothing to it. So we believe that Mr. Sue, and that's just one of many, many pieces of evidence that we have amassed. And let me just say this. The conflicting testimony that we got during the depositions, I think that if you're going to resolve that testimony in anyone's favor, it has to be Mr. Sue's. The Due Process Clause requires nothing less than that. So I submit to you that Mr. Sue has more than met his burden of proof of showing an appearance of bias. And one more point worth making, the state doesn't dispute anywhere in its brief, judges, that we have met that standard. They put all of their eggs in the basket of hoping that you would find there was no U.S. Supreme Court law that said appearance of bias was enough. You will search their briefs in vain for any dispute that we've shown an appearance of bias. They never dispute that. So I believe that the Due Process Clause absolutely requires that Mr. Sue be entitled to a new trial by a fair and impartial fact finder. Thank you. Unless you have any other questions, I'd like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Very good.
Thanks,
Judge. Ms. Stutz.
May it please the Court, Counsel, my name is Reetha Stotz. I'm with the Office of the Illinois Attorney General, and I represent the respondent. Just as an overview, there are three grounds for affirming the district court's judgment here: procedural default, the absence of clearly established Supreme Court law, and, of course, even barring those two reasons, if this court were to address this claim de novo, it would be barred by Teague and has already been explicitly rejected in Del Vecchio. I'm going to touch on procedural default and the 2254D question, but before I get to that, I want to clear up a little bit of confusion about the terminology. We don't dispute that the appearance of bias, as the Supreme Court uses that phrase, of course violates due process. The problem is that petitioner is using it to mean something different. The Supreme Court's always used that phrase to refer to cases where, even if the defendant can't show actual bias, he can show a strong enough probability of actual bias based on facts that are within the judge's knowledge. If the defendant can show that, then there is a due process problem. But the appearance of bias inquiry asks whether those facts would cause a possible temptation to the average judge to be biased. it's built into that inquiry, the idea that the judge knows of the facts. It doesn't make any sense to say, could a judge be tempted by something he doesn't know about? That's the way the Supreme Court's always used that phrase. The appearance of bias standard has always been limited to facts that are within the judge's knowledge, and the court has never held that due process requires a judge to recuse based on something that he doesn't know. So part of the confusion is we're using the phrase a different way. Of course we concede that the real appearance of bias, as shown by a probability based on facts the judge knows about, would violate due process. As far as petitioner's reference to Liljeburg, as they concede, it is not on point. That is a federal statutory recusal standard. It has nothing to do with the due process inquiry here. There's no discrepancy between the result that would occur anyway under 455 and under the due process clause, because even if petitioner were governed by 455, at the most he would have a technical violation of that rule, but he wouldn't get a new trial. 455 doesn't automatically require a new trial. The question under that statute would be, one of the questions would be, was there a real probability of injustice? And of course, the question would be, how could there be a probability of injustice if the judge didn't know? Petitioner is trying to mix and match with the federal statute. He's trying to use that sweeping recusal requirement in 455 and then hook it up with the favorable structural error standard from the due process cases. But he can't do that. He's limited to the due process cases from the Supreme Court. None of those say that due process requires recusal where the judge doesn't know of the facts. I'll move to the procedural default argument. Petitioner noted in his opening argument that he raised this argument in his reply brief in state court. That's not sufficient under Illinois law. Illinois Supreme Court Rule 341H7 says points that are first raised in the reply are waived. Even if he had raised it at the state appellate court level, he still would have needed to present it to the Illinois Supreme Court in order to satisfy the one complete round requirement. And the fact is, petitioner never raised the argument that he's arguing now in state court. He says that we have forfeited the default argument by addressing his argument on the merits in the district court. That's not true. We never addressed the argument petitioner is now making because we didn't even realize it was in his petition. The main thrust of his petition was that the witnesses were lying in their deposition testimony. There was a massive cover-up, and Judge Morrissey really did know about the connection between the Devanes and the victim. We responded to that argument. We said, Judge Morrissey's telling the truth. He did not know of any connection. Therefore, he couldn't have been biased. What petitioner didn't do is make this distinct argument he's making now that Judge Morrissey would have been required to recuse himself even though he didn't know. If that argument was in the petition at all, it certainly wasn't raised clearly. We didn't perceive the petition to raise that argument, and there's no reason we should have because that argument's unprecedented. There's no case from any court that applies that rule. So under the factors listed in Jones v. Hulick, this is a case where this court can look to the default argument, even though it's raised for the first time in the appellate court. We raised the argument at the first reasonable opportunity to do so, which was in this court, and the issue's not a difficult one. It can be resolved simply by looking to the briefs in our appendix. Petitioner hasn't raised a cause and prejudice argument, so there's no factual dispute to resolve, and this court can and should resolve. Consider the default argument, and because it is clearly defaulted, that's one reason to affirm. Another reason to affirm is the absence of clearly established Supreme Court law. While it's true there are cases that use the phrase appearance of bias, as I mentioned earlier, they don't encompass petitioner's case. Those cases don't say a judge has to recuse based on something he doesn't know about. Petitioner has never pointed to any case that so holds. And Liljeburg is not helpful. It's not a due process case. He needs a due process case. The only reason 2254D wouldn't apply is if the state court had not adjudicated his claim. The state court clearly did adjudicate the appearance of bias claim. They addressed it at pages A89 through A92 in petitioner's appendix. First, they said petitioner had to show a presumption of bias or that unfairness was improbable. Then they said,
As a matter of fact, Judge Morrissey was unaware of the connection between the victim and the Devanes, and then they concluded the petitioner hadn't made out his claim. They said he had failed to rebut the presumption of impartiality and, quote, unfairness was not probable during petitioner's trial. That's a perfect adjudication of an appearance of bias claim. They got the standard right and they got the answer right, because there is no appearance of bias if the judge doesn't know of the potentially biasing fact. The only dispute could be that they didn't use the phrase appearance of bias. Instead, they used presumption of bias or probability of unfairness. But that's just another way of saying appearance of bias. Even the Supreme Court has used a variety of phrases in talking about appearance of bias. They've used risk of bias, incentive to be biased, possible temptation to the average judge. It's all getting at the same concept. So because the state court clearly did adjudicate this claim, that's another reason this court can affirm. Petitioner needs clearly established Supreme Court law, and he doesn't have it. Unless there are any questions, ask the court to affirm the judgment.
Thank you. Ms. Hogan.
I will be brief. First of all, appearance of bias. I think the state just told you that the judge has to know of the fact. We have to prove the judge knew. I think Liljeburg, as well as Franklin, tell us that's not true. In fact, in Liljeburg, the judge denied that he knew anything about the biasing facts, and the U.S. Supreme Court accepted that for purposes of its analysis. It still retroactively recused him. Secondly, in Franklin, you acknowledge that you can't really take the judge's word for what he did or didn't know, because that's not always the last word on it. It's just too difficult to prove whether the judge actually had knowledge of biasing facts or was, in fact, biased. I think Henderson, your decision in Henderson clearly dictates that we have not defaulted this claim and that they cannot now raise this issue. They had four opportunities. I think the state just told you that we never raised this claim in our amended petition, our second amended petition, our motion for discovery to Judge Pallmeyer, our certificates of appealability to both the district court and this court. I believe that's five opportunities. I ask you to look at our briefs. They are identical to the arguments we're making now. Never once did the state make a procedural default argument, and they had plenty of opportunities. Henderson says they can't do it now. And finally, here's the good news again. If you agree with the state that there is no well-established federal law, I disagree with it, but you may not, you have the right to review this de novo. Let's make the law. If we don't think the U.S. Supreme Court has told us what appearance of bias means, then you get to decide it the way you think is fair and just, and let's take it up and let them tell us what it means. Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.